Don't pay retail for your diamond engagement ring or gift. Come to cleanorigin.com. Founded by a leading family in the diamond industry for more than a century, we're experts in lab-grown diamonds because that's all we do. Clean Origin, the only diamond jewelers who give you a 100-day, no-questions-asked return on your purchase. Head to cleanorigin.com or one of our retail stores and mention code RADIO10 for 10% off your purchase. That's cleanorigin.com, code RADIO10.
Why choose a Sleep Number smart bed?
Can I make my side softer?
Can I make my side firmer? Whenever I want?
Can we sleep cooler?
Sleep Number does that. Cools up to 8 times faster and lets you choose your ideal comfort on either side. 94% of Sleep Number smart sleepers report better sleep. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number 1 in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. To find a store near you, visit sleepnumber.com.
You may have noticed there's been plenty of conversation concerning our closest star over the past year or so. From the total solar eclipse in April to the increase in solar storms as we approach the solar maximum, the sun has been getting plenty of attention. So we wanted to take a deeper look into our celestial neighbor, and what better way to do that than to invite Dr. Alex Young, a heliophysicist, on the Weather Geeks podcast today. Dr. Young, welcome. Thank you for being here with us. We are so excited to chat not just about the eclipse, but about all things that has to do with our sun.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, this is going to be a great conversation. I'll run through some of the background, your background, for our listeners in just a moment. But first, I will start with the first question we ask all of our participants on Weather Geeks, which is, how did you become a weather geek? And in your case, it's okay to answer, how did you become a space weather geek?
Space weather geek. Okay. Well, I started pretty early. I actually wanted to be a scientist when I was in elementary school. And I said I wanted to be an astrophysicist. I'm not quite sure I knew what that was exactly, but when I was in the fourth grade. But I was exposed to things like the beginning of the shuttle program, the Voyager spacecraft. They were sending back pictures of Jupiter and Saturn. And at the same time, it was reruns of the original Star Trek and Carl Sagan's Cosmos. So all of that together, kind of the science fiction and the science itself came together. And that's, that I decided right then and there, that's what I wanted to do.
That's really cool. And I'm thinking back as a kid, how easy it is to be fascinated by that. But when did you know that this could be your job?
Well, that actually was much later. I mean, I sort of went through the kind of standard path. I enjoyed and took physics in high school and chemistry. And when I went to college, I got a degree in physics. But I actually thought I was going to do other things. I mean, as a kid, I had a telescope and, looked up at the sky and actually saw my first eclipse. It was not a total eclipse, but I saw a partial eclipse when I was a little kid. And all of that was interesting. I kind of went off on a sidetrack to do high energy particle physics, but then went to graduate school for something even different, something called chaos theory, which actually is kind of relevant, I guess, for weather and climate. And I did a summer project. And it was working for one of NASA's great observatories called the Compton Gamma Ray Observatory, which, the Hubble is one of the great ones that looks at visible light. And the Compton Gamma Ray Observatory looks at the most extreme kind of light, X-rays and gamma rays. And that's, I started doing very distant objects in the universe. And my advisor came in one day and said, hey, the sun is really close. And we have all this amazing data and people aren't really taking advantage of it. Would you be interested, after I got my master's, would you be interested in doing your PhD to study something called solar flares, and in particular, high energy radiation from solar flares? And that's what led me into doing this particular type of science. And my first job out of graduate school was as a contractor, science support scientist for a mission called SOHO, which was one of the big first big solar observatories, and that's that.
Yeah,
that's history. You know,
the rest is history.
Yeah,
I remember all the pictures actually coming out of SoHo. Yeah, like I remember sort of like a six panel or something, and all the colors. Yeah.
And this, that's the thing that was exciting for me is, when I did gamma ray, there were pictures, you know, we looked at basically squiggly lines. And when I started working from SoHo, there were all these beautiful pictures that I was looking at every day. And it was just totally enthralled with seeing the sun in a completely different way than I actually did in my research originally.
Yeah, and of course you've learned, and we've all learned, how much all these little storms, we'll call them, that are happening on the sun matter. Let me run through some of your background for our listeners. Dr. Young is now a NASA solar astrophysicist studying space weather in our solar system and beyond. He is the Associate Director for Science in the Heliophysics Science Division. Dr. Young's focus is to help make science communication approachable for the broad NASA community. And I just have to say, everything that you've done with us at the Weather Channel, you are carrying out that mission phenomenally.
And well,
we love talking with you.
That makes me feel good to know that I'm being successful as I learn how to be a better communicator.
Yeah, it's fantastic here. And you're great at making a really complicated topic here very approachable. Let's see, he's also taken his work in space weather education, public outreach, and media work for NASA, the love of science fiction, to enrich his goal to help all of us become better communicators. And you also, he helped lead NASA's national engagement efforts for the 2017 total solar eclipse. And that was one of the agency's largest public outreach events ever. This is a big one, though, too, coming up here soon. So, in fact, soon, this podcast will drop on Wednesday, the Wednesday before the total solar eclipse. So
Let's jump
into that.
All right.
And just first, I just want to kind of take a broader look at our fascination with eclipses. You know, throughout history, as time goes back, we've had a fascination with them. But I think first, because of the mystery of them, now we know when they're coming. So why do you think that amazement and fascination continues to linger?
Well, I mean, you know, if you look back, people have talked about them for thousands of years. They are so much of our mythology and our literature, and religions all over the world are just completely peppered with all these different talks about lunar eclipses and solar eclipses. And when you first experience a total solar eclipse, it is such an overwhelming, and I would say spiritual kind of feeling. I mean, it's because your senses experience something that they've never had before. Things happen that don't make sense. And I have friends who are scientists like me, and the very first time they did feel even a little bit of fear and sort of just a touch of terror, because it's just so much. But I can only imagine how much that motivated, scared, excited people a long time ago. And it just continues. You know, every time I've seen a solar eclipse, it's new, it's different, and it's still as exhilarating as it was the first time. And so I think that I would think most people feel that way. I do know a lot of scientists who, you know, we know the mechanics of it. You know, we know how it works and why it works. And including myself, we were all like, well, you know, it's going to be cool, but, you know, it's no big deal. I mean, we know what's happening. But once you actually see it, and once you actually experience it, it changes you. And that's what's so exciting about it. I mean, there are all these other aspects of, you know, the science that you can do is unique and amazing, but it's just such a wonderful, not just a visual, but a complete experience all the way around. And I think that every time another person sort of gets the bug and experiences it and just passes that excitement along, I think it's just going to continue to grow, and more people will hopefully want to see them and enjoy them.
We had gone such a long time since the last solar eclipse that was seen in the U.S. in 2017. Before that, it was the 70s, right? For the
full 79.
Total. Yeah. And so that was a long time. I think people really, there was a lot of people who didn't truly know what they would see or not see if they didn't get to the path of totality. Mm-hmm. And now, you know, what, we're 7 years removed from the last one. And, you know, there's, I think, people who maybe tried to see it last time, myself included, and then there were clouds, and we'll attempt again. But I think there's much more communication and description of what happened last time. So there are this one feels even bigger.
Absolutely.
Than the eclipse in 2017.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, it was such a challenge. I mean, NASA, because NASA doesn't normally do this sort of work. NASA really focuses on space. I mean, we study the sun and we study all these aspects of the sun and the moon and the earth, but we typically do it from space. So it's not really the normal focus for NASA. However, NASA does have, you know, an important mandate from the beginning in 58, which is to share its science and its information to the public. And part of it is actually an astronomer in the 80s, I think, 80s and 90s. His name is Fred Espenak, and some people call him Mr. Eclipse.
Yeah, yes.
Yeah, he started a NASA website, and it still is one of the standards for information. He created, with some of his colleagues, he created a catalog of 5,000 years of eclipses. So back 2,000 years in the past and 3,000 years in the future, which is just crazy that you can just basically flip to a page or go to one of the parts on the website and you can find an eclipse. And it's really, really cool. And that is one of the ways that NASA kind of got started into it. But then 2017 was just a chance to engage the public, you know, and to talk about not only the eclipse, but all the things that NASA does that are connected to it. And so that's really what helped us go along. But so many other people were doing it. And we had social media, which we didn't have in the past, and all these other things. And I will say, they're actually, I don't want to leave out Hawaii, because there was one in Hawaii in 91, but the contiguous U.S. didn't get one since 79. But even in 91, you know, we didn't have any of the ways that we communicate and we connect. And it really, 2017 really changed things.
Yeah. Right. And it, you know, I'm excited. I know there's a lot of excitement around this upcoming one next week. And it seems like there's a lot of people potentially in the path of totality, as well as the ability to travel to it. And plus, you know, all of North America is in at least a partial, which is something.
Yes,
so
absolutely.
I keep urging people, like, you still need, if you can't get to the path of totality, it's okay. You should still go up and observe the partial with your glasses, your solar glasses, because that in itself, I think, is remarkable, too. But we've got more than 2,000 miles in the U.S. in totality. The width averages 115 miles. So we've got a lot of ground to work with if the weather will cooperate.
Oh, yeah. I know we're all nervous about the weather. And as I pay attention to it, just, you know, I know, of course, you all do. My wife and I, as we get ready to go to Texas, are checking it all the time. So, I'm glad you mentioned the partial eclipse, because I do feel like, even sometimes from the eclipse community, that people really push totality, which is fantastic. I mean, totality is amazing. I didn't get to see it in 2017. I've seen it other times, but 2017 I was clouded out. But the partial eclipse is still really amazing. Not only, of course, you have the solar viewing glasses, which you need to protect your eyes during the partial phase, no matter what. But you can look at them with the solar viewing glasses, but you can also, project onto, into a, you can make a little box that you can project into.
The pinhole projector.
Yeah.
The classic. I mean, I hope that every classroom is making a pinhole projector.
Absolutely. I mean, I took a colander. You can take a colander and hold it up. And you can even use the leaves on the trees. You know, they actually, just like you're holding your hand like this with the sun behind you, makes little pinholes. But the leaves on trees that cross over make little pinholes. So that in itself is amazing. But there are other things that happen. So, for example, shadows start to get, as we get closer and closer towards totality, but still in the partial phase, shadows get very sharp. You know, the shadows are kind of blurry, but as we get closer, they get very sharp. And that's very distinct and a really cool thing to look at, because you can start to see the shadows change. The other thing is, for those that are at what we call a deep partial, where you're, let's say, 80% or 85%, you may, in fact, depending on where you are, even start to notice some of the animals changing. Because the light will change and you will notice the light changing a little bit. So you start to get that experience if you look around you and just kind of pay attention to what's around you. And that gives you a feeling for where you're going as we're going towards totality. And so that part is still really exciting, and there's a lot of cool things you can get out of it.
Yeah, no, and I think it's pretty cool that potentially most people across North America might be looking up at a, you know, around the same 2-hour window, right? Just trying to see what's out there. I feel very much a togetherness when I think of it that way. Are we in eclipse season? Because we just had a penumbral eclipse, a lunar eclipse, 2 weeks ago.
Yes, we're in eclipse season. So usually there are two eclipse seasons in a year. They're usually in the fall and the spring. Sometimes it can be a little bit later. Sometimes there's three, but when you have an eclipse season, you get two eclipses. You get a lunar eclipse and a solar eclipse. There are times when you may get more depending on, but there it's very rare. But typically, you know, you have a full moon where the sun is shining on the earth, and that's projecting the earth's shadow on the moon. So you have sun, earth, moon. So that's a lunar eclipse. So the sun is shining this way on Earth, and then it projects the shadow onto the moon. But then, roughly 15 or so days later, you have the new moon, and now you have sun, moon, Earth. And so now the shadow is the sun is shining on the moon, and that is casting a shadow on the Earth. And so that's what we call the eclipse season, is that they're usually roughly six months or so apart. And so you could always expect that you're going to have these kinds of pairs at least.
One of my favorite words is the word syzygy.
Oh, yeah.
I should spell it S-Y-Z-Y-G-Y.
I could not spell it if you paid me right now.
A little side story. For one Halloween, my family and I dressed up as a family costume of King Tides. And I was the moon, my husband was the King Tide, and the kids were the Earth and the Sun. And I made us like carry a banner that said syzygy. I'm definitely that geeky mom. Anyway, it was a good learning experience for all, because I think King Tides are actually quite scary because they cause a lot of flooding. But at any rate, with the word syzygy, you know, we have that every lunar cycle. We always have a new moon and we always have a full moon. Mm-hmm. So I think people need to know why we don't have an eclipse every time we have a new moon and a full moon.
Yeah. So that's a really cool thing to think about. So it turns out that, you know, actually I usually do this with paper plates. I have some in my office, but I don't want to step away. But I give talks sometimes to kids, and I oftentimes use two paper plates to show. So if you take two paper plates and you cut a slit in them and you put them like this, and then you make them flat. And then what you can do is you can show that it turns out that the Earth orbits in a plane called the ecliptic plane, which is the Earth-Sun plane. And most of the planets are in the ecliptic. But the moon orbits the Earth at an angle. So it actually sometimes is a little bit above the Earth and sometimes it's a little bit below the Earth. So that's why when you have a new moon or a full moon, but the moon is too far above the Earth or too far below the Earth, the shadow is not cast, you know, the shadows are not cast on the other objects. They're cast into space.
Oh, it's about the shadow. Yes, yes.
Yeah, and so when the moon is actually orbiting, but in the plane of the sun and Earth, and it's a new moon or a full moon, then you get the eclipses. And so depending on how far it is, there's a little bit of a leeway there. That's when, if it's a little bit above, you may have that shadow from the moon partially cast on, you know, part of the shadow is on the Earth. And that's what we call a partial eclipse. So everybody sees a partial eclipse. But then if the shadow is far enough down where it's all of the shadow is cast on the Earth, then you have a total eclipse. And so if you're in this little narrow path, narrow, I say relative to the Earth, it's still, you know, 100 miles wide or so. Then if you're in that path, you will see the partial eclipse, and then there'll be a point, you know, for maybe a few minutes or even sometimes seconds when the moon will completely block out the sun, and then you see totality. And so the same sort of thing with lunar eclipses, you know, depending on where it is, the shadow, you know, it may not be completely cast on the moon. It may be slightly out of it. So then you don't get a total. And the totals for lunar eclipses are cool because they you're actually getting refracted light from around the Earth, which is basically where all the sunsets are happening. So you get this red shadow, and that's why we have full moons. They sometimes we call blood moons.
Blood moons.
Yeah, which is a really cool thing to see.
I want to ask you a question that other people have asked me, and I know the answer, but I need you to answer it. Can we chase the eclipse?
You sure can. You sure can. Except you can only chase it so far because the shadow is really fast. So, and you know, you can chase it with airplanes, and we're doing that to give us a little bit more time. But I think there's only been one time when we actually followed the shadow for a long period, which was with a Concorde back when we had those. Because the shadow can travel anywhere from about 1,000 miles an hour up to, at the very end of the eclipse, it can be like about 6,000 miles an hour. So it's just it's just nothing that can catch it. But if you know, for example, the shadow's moving and you know the weather before it gets there, then you can chase it in the sense that you could travel somewhere else, you know, say farther along the path. But by the time that shadow gets to you, you will not catch it. It is moving way too fast.
We're going to take a quick break, and we come back. I'm going to ask what makes a good location to see totality. And we're going to talk about solar maximum, too. We'll be right back.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply. CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Welcome back to our Weather Geeks podcast. I'm meteorologist Jen Carfagno hosting today, and I'm talking with Dr. Alex Young from NASA. He's a heliophysicist, and we're talking about the total solar eclipse coming up. We just ended with the fact that chasing it is kind of an elusive prospect, unless you're unconquered yet. But what would make a good totality location? Obviously, being in the path of totality here is assumed, but is there any certain landscape viewing area that would make it the best?
Well, I mean, it does. So, of course, there are certain things that you may want during an eclipse. Now, for example, you may being around trees or being out, you know, in nature is really great because you get to experience the changes in the shadows. You get to experience the changes in the animals. So that's certainly something you might want in terms of the experience. But then the main thing that you really need to think about is weather. That is really the key thing. And that can depend also on, are you close to water, for example, in terms of how the clouds may evolve. Actually, I just read a paper recently that says that this was something people talked about, you know, anecdotally, that as eclipses moved over, the cumulus clouds went away and then came back. And it turns out that that's actually been studied now. So as the shadow moves over, when things cool down, cumulus clouds disappear. But then as the shadow moves on and it heats back up, then the cumulus clouds come back. So
that's fascinating and kind of promising too, right?
Yeah. Like, so there can be there can be some very sudden weather changes that can be either to your benefit, or, you know, it could actually work against you. That's one of the challenges. I'm definitely just sort of learning, because I'm, you know, my expertise is not in weather. So I'm still sort of learning about how the atmosphere changes. But so that's another key issue, is weather. It's probably the number one thing.
The number one. It seems to me geography might play a bit of a role, like maybe being on the lee side of the mountains versus the upslope might give you more of a fighting chance.
For example, I've experienced that being in South America, being along the Andes, depending on which side you're on. That was also the case in 2017. So Oregon, if you're on one side, is more desert-like, and then the other side is much rainier. So that's definitely, that can be a huge issue. And the other thing that's also of benefit, which I haven't experienced, but if you are up on a mountain, you can see the shadow much, you know, it's much more obvious to see the shadow traveling across the land. Of course, it's very quick, but you can see it. I did experience that in the desert, which I didn't see in other places. But you see this kind of dome, you know, of darkness that comes around like this around the sun, and then it's coming towards you, and that's a pretty cool effect. I would love to experience one, you know, on a mountain that looks down on some plains. To see that shadow rushing in.
Take like eclipse chasing to the next level. Like not only trying to get to the path of totality, but get to the pinnacle of the path of totality.
That would take some serious planning. But I know that was an opportunity that came up in 2017. People were in Grand Teton and some other areas out west where they got to do some of that. That would be really cool.
I know there's going to be a lot of scientists studying things. Animal noise, of course, how the light affects temperature. It's such a short moment. What do we get out of these scientific measurements that we're taking?
Well, there's, you know, so there's a whole bunch of different things. Again, 2017 kind of opened a lot of that up. It wasn't necessarily unknown, but 2017 was a unique opportunity because it went across so much land that was accessible. And that's really one of the challenges, because eclipses happen everywhere, and a lot of them happen, you know, majority of the Earth is covered in ocean. So a lot of them happen in places that you can't get to, or in remote places. But one of the things that we, of course, always want to study during an eclipse is the corona. That's the outer atmosphere that we see during totality, which can just be amazing. You see all sorts of different structures, these streams coming out, the kind of silvery, silky. The one I saw last year, my wife kind of described it as like flower petals, kind of white flower petals. So the corona is very important to study, because the corona, as we'll talk about space weather eventually, the corona is where space weather originates. So that's very, very important. It's an important part of the sun. But there's some really cool opportunities here on the ground. It's a great opportunity to study the atmosphere. The uppermost layer of the atmosphere, called the ionosphere, which is actually sort of an electrical, it's a electrical gas. It's a type of matter called plasma, which is very much like a liquid or a gas, but it has electrical properties, which makes it more interesting. But it also interacts with our communications, with our ability to send GPS, radio waves bounce off it to give a shortwave radio. And when this is created by the light of the sun, it changes from day to night. But of course, that's a very subtle change, you know, a much slower change. But during an eclipse, you have sunlight, and then all of a sudden, this patch is experiencing darkness like nighttime. And the ionosphere changes in that small region just like it does when we go from day to night. When that happens, the properties of it, its temperature, its density, all kinds of things change. And how signals propagate through it or off of it change. And so this is an opportunity for scientists to study that. And it's even an opportunity for citizens in citizen science to help out. In this case, there's a program called HAMSCI, which is ham operators. And all of those ham operators basically have radio receivers. And if you transmit radio waves, you have all these people across the country or across the path, they can study how the ionosphere is changing as it's moving over. So that's a really great opportunity, which was done in 2017 and will be done again. But we also put up high altitude balloons to measure changes in the temperature, the wind speed, because that's happening too. Again, you know, with weather, there's all of a sudden this region that's being cooled with lack of sunlight, we can study the weather changes. And another aspect is even studying climate. And the way that's done is the shadow itself kind of acts like a cloud as it moves, you know, as it's moving. And so we can take that information and use it in climate models, because one of the big challenges for climate is the impact of clouds. Clouds are a huge challenge because some clouds reflect, some clouds absorb. And so it's a great chance to, when you know exactly where that cloud is, you know, you have very specific information. And so that's a unique opportunity.
Yeah. Is any of the sun's energy getting through, or not through, but around? I mean, we're still getting some, right? Like, I think about a cloud. Brought a cloud, it made me think, okay, but we still get something out of clouds, you know, so to speak, whether it's, they're not.
Right. I mean, we're still getting some solar energy. It's mostly scattered light, so it's not direct light. But of course, the one thing we do know is we can actually measure, we'd actually know exactly how much, which is the difference for a cloud. We may not be able to easily know how much energy is getting there, but what you see is actually, I've seen a recent movie that NASA put out of the amount of solar energy. And so you see this sort of spot, and around the spot, you see the amount of energy increasing slowly as you move away from that spot. And then you see that move across the, you know, along the path. So we can calculate sort of exactly how much energy is reaching the Earth through that whole area where the eclipse is impacted. So not only the totality, you know, the total part, but also the partial phase.
It's also fascinating. I think this is a good transition into, I had teased that I wanted to talk about solar maximum, because that's been in the news a lot too, you know, that we're approaching our solar maximum. Let's just take a few steps back. And can you answer what causes this, and, you know, how long will we be in solar maximum? Put that in quotes.
Well, so what drives solar activity are basically two main things. Three. The sun itself is this strange kind of matter called a plasma. So the sun is not solid. It's very much like a liquid or a gas, but it's electrical in nature. You know, it is response to electricity and magnetism. And the sun also rotates differentially. That is, it rotates faster at the equator than it does at the poles. Which is exactly what happens for the planet Saturn and Jupiter, which is why you see those bands on the planets. And then lastly, the key energy source on top of that is magnetic fields. So the sun is kind of like a big, giant liquid magnet. It's got a big magnetic field, very similar to the Earth. It has a north and a south. And those magnetic fields get twisted up over time because they get dragged by the motion of the sun itself. And so what happens is the magnetic fields kind of start off in a very simple, simple geometry. And then over time, they get dragged around and twisted and knotted up inside the sun. And they start popping out. Those areas where they're knotted up start popping out. And we get sunspots. So sunspots are where these magnetic fields are popping out. And as we move forward in time, they get more and more twisted, and more of those sunspots start popping out. And eventually, those sunspots themselves are twisted so much that they, you know, if you take a rubber band and you twist it and twist it and twist it, it's got energy built up in it. And then if you let it go, it all of a sudden goes back to just being a simple rubber band, and it's released all that energy. And we can't really see much of it, but it heated up when you did that very, very slightly, and it pushed the air when you did that. But that happens on a much stronger, grander scale on the sun. So eventually those magnetic fields will all of a sudden just have too much energy built up, and they release. And when they do that, they heat up the area around them. They spit material. They push material out into space. And so one of the things that causes is a huge flash of light called a solar flare. And then there are these big blobs of solar material, solar stuff that we actually call them coronal mass ejections. And this buildup of magnetic energy happens over many years. And then once all that energy is dissipated, then it goes back to being kind of a relaxed sun. So we go from nice, relaxed magnetic fields to very twisted magnetic fields back down to very relaxed magnetic fields over about 11 years. And that 11 years is called the sunspot cycle or the solar activity cycle. And so right now, we are getting very close, or we may actually be at that peak. It's really hard to know exactly when you're there. You kind of have to wait till you've passed it so that you can look back and see it. But we are pretty much right at solar maximum, where we have the most number of sunspots, we have the most activity, and that period is not like a short period of time. It usually can last, you know, maybe a year or two. So we will be experiencing much more of this solar activity, of these, you know, huge explosions sending out energy and sending out material from the sun over you know, the next couple of years, they'll continue. There'll just be less and less of it. So it doesn't mean that you never have it during solar minimum. We still see solar activity, but it's just, it's much smaller scale, and it's the amount of it is less, and the size of it is less. But one of the cool things that we'll have, and people may have already noticed this, is we'll start seeing more aurora, because one of the impacts that we'll talk about for space weather, the one that's the beautiful impact that we enjoy seeing, is actually this material from the sun interacting with our atmosphere and magnetic field, creating these beautiful displays of light and near the North and South Pole called aurora. So that's a wonderful aspect of space weather.
Indeed. And I do want to talk about that. I do want to ask, though, before we get too far from the eclipse, does the fact that we are at solar maximum mean anything to this total solar eclipse we're about to see?
It does. It does, actually. So one of the things that is important is the corona itself changes depending on where it is in the solar cycle. So as we get close to solar maximum, the corona gets much more spiked, and it's much more complicated because of all these magnetic fields. And so basically what that means is its structure changes over the solar cycle. So what you see during a total solar eclipse is different depending on what year you are and where you are in the solar cycle. So what the corona that people saw in 2017 is going to be very different than what we're going to see this year. And even what we saw last year, the eclipse I saw last April on 2023, where we had these like rose, kind of these petals and spikes coming out in all direction. That's more like what we'll see now. Whereas in 2017, they actually more cluster towards the equator. So typically the spikes are kind of mostly around the equator. I think we had one that was poking out like this, but they were much more confined. Whereas in this year, they're going to be like, you know, all coming out in all directions, as opposed to being kind of closer to the equator. So,
wow.
So we're going to see them change. And that's one of the things that's exciting. Not only are the conditions different depending on where you are and when you are and weather and things like that, but what you see changes, and that makes every eclipse unique visually.
Every eclipse is unique, just like a snowflake.
Absolutely.
Just like a snowflake. Everyone is different. That is fascinating and very cool to think about. And this feels like this one in 2024 is kind of like the best case scenario, because we're at solar maximum. There's a lot of population that has the opportunity to see it. Of course, you know, this is all dependent on the weather, but yeah. This feels even more exciting by the moment. All right, back to the solar maximum though. So I did want to talk about that. And I looked at, just in preparing for this, I looked at the sunspot cycles, and it seems like, first of all, like you stay elevated for a number of years with like little tiny spikes. There's just a lot of activity. It's not just like, you know, a curve or even a
right.
line up
yeah.
and then down. But also that, how does this sunspot cycle compare to previous ones? Because it seems like they're all different. And does
right.
it matter?
Yeah, so they are all different. Some are a little bit longer, some are a little bit shorter. But the other thing that's kind of more interesting is that some are higher, the activity goes higher, and some goes lower. So it turns out that the last solar cycle was the weakest solar cycle in about 100 years. So it was about the same size as the solar cycle, you know, 100 years ago, in the early 1900s. Originally, a prediction was made during the at the end of the last solar cycle of what this solar cycle was going to be. And the prediction was it would be about the same, maybe even a little bit weaker. However, this solar cycle has turned out that it's actually much, it's bigger. It's not as big as some of the previous ones that have, that we've had in the past several cycles, but it is noticeably different, and it's gotten noticeably larger much sooner than the last one. So, for example, the number of solar flares we see, which is, you know, the more flares is typically for a more active cycle, you have more solar flares, and more larger solar flares, for example. So we've seen about twice as many of the kind of medium to larger size solar flares as we did in the last cycle. And the sunspot number was peaked out at about 115. And that doesn't necessarily mean anything, but relatively, this current one is already reached about 160. So it's substantially larger. So that's one of the things that we've already noticed is this cycle is stronger than the last cycle.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Welcome back to the Weather Geeks podcast. We were talking about solar maximum. I'm talking with Dr. Alex Young, heliophysicist at NASA. And we touched on the fact that when you're at a maximum, you might have even more opportunity to see the aurora borealis, the northern lights. Mm-hmm. And one question is, does that actually goes for the southern lights as well, right?
Correct. Yeah.
The aurora australis.
Yeah.
So is this the year, like, everyone to try to go see it? When it means, like, we have a better chance, is it just at higher latitudes? Is there a better chance that we'll see the northern lights perhaps at lower latitudes?
Both. So over the next, probably the rest of this year and into next year, and maybe even following that, it will be more frequent. So we'll continue to have more frequent and larger of these coronal mass ejections, these big burps of solar material. So that's what's going to create stronger aurora. So if we have stronger aurora, not only will it be more frequent, but when we do have stronger aurora, it actually goes farther south. So the aurora is typically in an oval over the poles, for the North Pole and the South Pole. And as the solar activity gets stronger, that makes the auroral oval stronger, and it actually extends farther south. And so what will happen is people farther south will start to see aurora overhead. So, you know, let's say like the lower Canada and places like that will start to see aurora overhead where they normally wouldn't. But what that also means is those of us who live a bit farther south will see the aurora on the horizon. So, because for example, the auroral oval, you can, if you're farther south than the auroral oval, you will see it on the horizon. You won't see the aurora overhead, but you'll see it on the horizon. So that's going to happen more. And so, I mean, I live in Maryland, so I'm hoping that, you know, I'm going to see it farther south. Now, you can actually, we have had in history some of the largest storms. People have seen it much farther south. That means it's a really big solar storm, and it's much rarer. But it does happen, and it will happen again. When, we don't really know, but you could potentially have storms there. You could see it in Florida. There are historical storms that people saw it in Cuba, you know, closer to the equator.
I went to the Space Weather Prediction Center in Boulder once, NOAA Space Weather Prediction Center, and I learned a lot that when, especially we see these extreme events where the aurora can be seen all the way down at lower latitudes, oftentimes it means it's a big storm that is causing other problems.
Right.
Can you talk about the other problems? I mean, we look at this beautiful visual, and I think a lot of people don't realize there's a lot happening in the atmosphere and, you know, the ionosphere, really,
right.
That is mucking things up.
So, yeah. So actually, I meant to do this. I bought these especially for the sun. So I wanted to wear my sunglasses. I wanted to wear these especially for you the first time we talked. So
I love them.
So exactly as the auroral oval spreads farther south, then we get aurora farther south. But the stronger the storms, the stronger the impact's gonna be. And so there's a couple of different things that can happen. So just as we mentioned the eclipse changing the light that's hitting the atmosphere, which changes the ionosphere. Space weather also changes the ionosphere. So all of this, both the flash from the solar flare. So, you know, normally the ionosphere, you know, changes day to night because of the light coming from the sun, the ultraviolet light primarily. When you have a solar flare, it's a very intense burst of not just ultraviolet light, but even stronger, more energetic light, like X-rays. And so when that light hits the upper atmosphere, the ionosphere, that also changes it. And so that disrupts communication. So typically when we have large, you know, medium-sized to large flares, wherever the sun is right overhead, you can see these maps where you can see, you know, where the sun is right overhead is where the flare is most intense, and that part of the earth will experience communication disruptions that can last for minutes to, you know, to maybe even an hour for a really big flare. The other thing that happens is that intense burst of energy from a flare also heats the atmosphere, and it causes the atmosphere to expand. So if you have a spacecraft that's orbiting, and you know the atmosphere has a certain density here, if the solar flare heats up the atmosphere, that causes it to expand, and all of a sudden the spacecraft is experiencing more atmosphere, and hence it experiences drag. And that, if the drag is strong enough and we can't compensate for it quickly enough, that can cause a satellite or spacecraft to lose orbit. And in fact, that's exactly what happened in, I think it was last year, 2023, in February, SpaceX was launching Starlink, some of their Starlink satellites. And I think they launched something like 48 or so. And there was a solar storm, actually two solar storms that came back to back, that what they didn't anticipate, that caused the atmosphere to expand, and they lost about 30 something of their spacecraft. They burned up in the atmosphere.
I didn't realize that was why that happened.
Yeah, that actually wasn't a solar flare. That was actually from the CMEs, though, because they can also basically put energy into the atmosphere and cause it to expand. So, they didn't really account for that, and that's, you know, they were sort of unexpected, and that's what happened.
That seemed like important forecast information for. Launches, rocket launches.
Absolutely.
What about for sort of the touristy type of, you know, barely get up into outer space and come back down? Could those craft be affected by this?
Absolutely. So, I mean, this is already the case that, you know, when NASA or any other organization launches a rocket, they pay attention, you know, primarily to NOAA. NOAA does forecasts for this. There is also a group at Johnson's Space Center in Houston that focuses specifically on high energy radiation, which is important for astronauts because they can be susceptible to radiation when they're up high out of the atmosphere, and also eventually going to the moon or Mars. They'll no longer be protected by the magnetic field of the Earth, which acts as kind of a big force field or a shield. But launches are something we pay attention to, and we will have to pay attention as we do more of these. I guess they're typically called suborbital flights, where you like fly to a really high altitude and then come down, because the higher you go, the less atmosphere there is and the weaker the magnetic field is. And so high energy particles that can also result from the solar flares and the coronal mass ejections, which are basically a type of radiation, you are more susceptible if you're higher up in the atmosphere. So if you're high up in the atmosphere and there's a huge event that releases a burst of these radiation particles, you would be potentially exposed to much higher levels. That's also of concern for airline staff, pilots, and airline attendants who typically take polar routes, you know, or flying very, very high. Like if you're going to go from New York to Shanghai, for example, typically you would fly over the poles. But during a solar storm, there will be more radiation potentially at, you know, higher altitude, you know, at altitudes up at the poles. And so you would be not necessarily dangerous immediately, but one of the things that's concerned of radiation is what's your long-term exposure. I mean, typically you shouldn't have too much over a lifetime, because we all are exposed to, you know, minor amounts of it naturally. It's just the long-term exposure that we're concerned about.
Yeah. Well, airlines change their routes.
Yes, they do. They absolutely do. And so that's important for them, because if you change your route, especially if you're taking a polar route, which is the shortest, you're now going to have to take a longer route, and it's going to take more fuel. And so it's going to cost more. And so that impacts the airline's ability to get to a place, you know, in a timely fashion, or to expend a certain amount of fuel. And so that's very important. And the FAA will, you know, if there's a huge solar event with a radiation storm, we call them, NOAA will issue an alert, and then the FAA will say, you know, this is an alert for polar routes to reroute them. And that certainly has happened.
So I've read that these big solar storms could affect power grids, et cetera. And what kind of stopgap is there on this infrastructure? Kind of like a massive surge protector or something like that to protect from it.
That's exactly the right way to describe it. So there's a couple of things that can happen. So, you know, one of the things that when these solar storms basically are energizing the ionosphere, one of the things that they do, and this is actually part of what drives the aurora, is it creates this electrical current. So there's a current going around the Earth like this up high in the ionosphere. And if that current is energized enough and it's strong enough, it can actually induce a current on the ground. And that happens, I mean, it's natural that there are currents induced on the ground. They're much smaller, but they do happen all the time. But these ones that happen during a solar storm are very strong. So that means the currents that are induced on the ground are very strong. And the places that currents will be induced are typically large conductors. And so an example of a large conductor would be a transmission line, especially a long one, let's say going from substations. So then you would have a transmission lines that are, you know, miles or kilometers long. And those are the ones that will pick up these currents. And so the power network is not made to have these extra current flowing through it. And that current also is different kind of current than what is normally in these power lines. And so if there's a surge, it can trip the circuits and basically cause kind of a temporary blackout. Or if the current lasts long enough, because you can have solar storms that last for quite a while in terms of, you know, days, then those currents will be heating up the large transformers. And so if they heat them up, they could potentially melt them. And that has happened. The most famous example in modern times is 1989 was a large solar storm that knocked out the power in Quebec, in the Quebec hydro power system. But that impact propagated down into the northeastern U.S. and in New Jersey, some transformers were heated up and they melted. So that's a very concern because that is more long-term. I mean, if it just trips a circuit, you know, you can eventually wait for things to calm down and address that. So what you said is exactly right. One of the types of mitigation, one of the things that you can do about it is to literally turn it off. So I guess the best analogy would be if you live somewhere where there's lightning storms, where you're going to have a thunderstorm and lightning, you know, you may want to unplug your TV. You know, you may want to unplug your computer because your surge protector may not be good enough if lightning strikes your house or strikes near your house. And so the easiest thing to do is to unplug it, and there's no way for the lightning to reach it. So you can do that with a power grid. You can unplug it. Now, they certainly are trying to develop technology that can handle these big events. And that's a challenge because they don't happen very often. So it's not like you can test it all the time.
It's kind of like a Cat 5 hurricane. They don't happen all the time, but we're trying to protect against them.
Exactly. Well, that's really the way to think about it. I mean, it's exactly like storms. You know, we get these really big ones. We get 100-year floods or 1,000-year floods, but they're very rare. When they happen, they're huge and they have a huge impact. And so space weather is the same way. The smaller events happen all the time, and they have impacts, minor impacts that we can address, and we can improve our technology. But every so often, you have what we like to call a low probability, high impact. You know, it's a very low chance, but if it happens, it's going to really have a big effect. And that's certainly where we stand with space weather, just like having a Category 5 hurricane, or, you know, I can't remember the terms for the largest tornadoes, but I know there's a scale for tornadoes.
Yeah, 5? Yeah, no, right. The same for all of the most extreme weather events. I can see how you can correlate that to the most extreme space weather events, is they just don't happen all that often. But of course, they're the things that we are most afraid of.
Right, right. And so there are a lot of things people are doing. There's a lot of technological changes. The challenge we also face is that we are a very technological society. We're very dependent on technology, and it's only going to get more we're only going to get more sophisticated in our technology, and we're only going to become more and more dependent on it. But the question is, what's the impact going to be with space weather? And we didn't have a lot of the same technology we have now in the last solar cycle, 11, you know, the last solar maximum 11 years ago. And 11 years from now, when we have the next solar maximum, we're going to have stuff that we maybe didn't even imagine you know, which is great. But what's the impact going to be, you know?
Right.
Who knows?
Right. Well, we do have to wrap this up, but I wanted to ask just some final tips from you on viewing, well, both the eclipse and the aurora. So let's start first with like your top three tips for viewing either whether it's totality or the partial, but viewing the eclipse coming up next week.
Well, I think the number one thing that I would say is the first thing to think about is safety. The most important thing is safety. So whether you're in totality or not, everyone will experience the partial phase. And the partial phase has a lot of cool things about it. And it's really exciting to watch the moon slowly kind of chew away at the sun. And but you've got to have either those glasses, and that's not sunglasses. Absolutely. These are very special. They're very, very, very dark. And regular sunglasses will not work, or any kind of sunglasses. So if you have those, you can look directly at it. And if you don't, take advantage and do projection methods, or you know, even use nature, because nature will protect it. The one thing, but the other thing I would think that comes to mind, so that you can enjoy it, because I think that's the most important thing, is to remember it's an experience. Because not only will the what's happening at the sun change, but the environment around you is going to change, you know, the light is going to change, the shadows are going to change, depending on how much of a partial eclipse, you may even feel a slight temperature change. It's just going to be an experience. And so enjoy that. It's really amazing. And so the other thing is, don't worry about taking a picture. There are a lot of people who are really good and professionals who will take some amazing pictures, and we will see them all over the internet and all over social media. But don't, especially if it's your first time, don't worry about that. Just enjoy the eclipse, enjoy the visuals, but enjoy all the whole experience, and then share it with your friends and family. Because I think you mentioned this earlier. You know, you are watching this event that is one of the most spectacular events in nature, that is allowing you to see things with, you know, that you could normally never see from the ground, you know, with protection or in totality when there's a total eclipse. And you're experiencing this with millions of other people, you know?
Yeah.
It's just going to be amazing. I mean, and this particular eclipse is more than 10 million more people than 2017 will literally be able to just walk out their front door. And hopefully, if the skies are clear, we'll be able to see totality. And that's just that's exciting to think about the opportunity for so many more people.
I hope everyone knows about it. I mean, I would think you'd have to live under a rock to not, but I would feel so bad if somebody was in the path of totality and all of a sudden realized, oh, I missed it. You know, they're head down on their computer at a meeting or whatever. I truly do hope that everyone gets to see it. Okay, real quick, your favorite tips on seeing the aurora. What's your advice?
Well, definitely. The other thing is, aurora is also very dependent on the weather. So there are a lot of great places. There's a much more limited, but there's so many good tourist organizations that not necessarily need to use them to do the aurora watching, but they have a lot of tips and help on where you can go. What are the best places to go in the U.S. or Canada or, in Europe are some of the best places to go. So keep your eyes out. And it's probably, you know, it would be helpful. Watch space weather, you know, go to, you know, I'm not promoting any particular site, but, you know, I know the Weather Channel, you know, talks about space weather. Keep an eye on that. There are other sites.
You can promote your own site.
Yeah. Well, I have a site called thesuntoday.org. There's earthsky.org. It's a really great place. The Earth Sky has a daily blog, which I help with, that, you know, that provides information from NOAA and NASA. NOAA is a great place. And, you know, NOAA is the Just like for the Weather Service, the National Weather Center, you know, NOAA is the premier place to forecast that, and they have great maps. There's another one called spaceweatherlive.com, which has apps you can use. You can get them on your phone. You can get alerts. Spaceweather.com is another great place. All of them will have alerts about when is the aurora going to potentially be visible. And then you have to, once you have an idea of where you're going to go and when is a good opportunity, because you're probably going to want to, say, pick a week to go somewhere, because you're going to have to deal with weather as well as what's the sun doing, you know, because there will be times when the sun isn't doing very much. I just got back from Alaska, unfortunately, and the week I went was very, very clear, but the sun wasn't doing anything. And so I didn't see any aurora, which was too bad. But you'll need to then look for what are the local sites, because a lot of the space weather information that you would see is very global. And so you need to get very, very localized information. So depending on where you go, whether it's Canada or, you know, Alaska or Norway, all of them have very local organizations and social media, as well as just websites where you can get the local information, and they can help you. It's definitely challenging. It's a lot more challenging than an eclipse. The eclipse, you know where it's going to be. You know when it's going to be there. But aurora, that's actually kind of what makes aurora watching a little bit more exciting, because it is definitely much more difficult, you know, yes. But boy, is it worth it.
Fantastic. Dr. Alex Young, thank you so much for this discussion today. Appreciate your time. This was fantastic. I'm so excited for the eclipse, and maybe one day I'll get to see the Northern Lights. I'll give it a shot.
Well, thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure, and I so much love talking to everyone at the Weather Channel, and you guys are great.
Awesome. And to everyone listening, thank you for being here. We will see you next time on the Weather Geeks Podcast.
Here in America, work is in trouble. We've offshored our manufacturing, sent away good jobs, and lost so much ability to make things. American Giant is a company that's pushing back against this tide. They make high-quality clothing, sweatshirts, jeans, dresses, jackets, and so much more right here in the USA. Visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order when you use code STAPLE20 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, promo code STAPLE20.